Okay, yeah, so it's not a talk, it's not a tutorial, but I'm standing up here with a pointer and there's a projector and there's there's code in here, so it's a discussion. What I'm going to lead this discussion about is, you know, how do we, it's sort of one of the fundamental things that is at the heart of what we're all doing here, which is how do we tell what kind of star, what are the physical properties of a star that we see given whatever observations we have of it. And something that I, right, so here's just, you know, putting this out. We want, what we really care about for most of the science questions that we're going after are things like, you know, the mass and radius of the star, its luminosity, if we want to know, you know, what the equilibrium temperature of a planet is, the age of the star. And then what we have is all of this stuff. So we have broadband photometry, we have maybe a parallax, we have might have a spectrum, you know, astroseismic, you know, oscillation frequencies, density of a star from a transit, maybe a rotation period. So we have all these like disparate measurements of a star, and we want to get back to its physical parameters. And so this is something that they're sort of, you know, very roughly like two different philosophies on how to try to do this, you know, which I'd call sort of model-based and data-driven. And what I'm going to talk about today is the model-based strategy, where basically, you know, we've gotten pretty good, we think, at simulating the physics of stars and how they're born and how they evolve and what their internal properties are and what their observational properties are. And a lot of people have made sort of grids of these stellar model calculations, you know, that are, you know, tied to these numerical physics calculations. And that's opposed to sort of a different strategy, which is just got tons of data of lots of different stars, and we know what some of them look like, you know what the properties of some of them are, maybe by some other methods, and you try to infer what the properties of the rest of them are just in a purely data-driven way. And I think Melissa's going to talk about this subject later this week. But I'm going to be talking about the first of these. So the background to, you know, sort of why I'm talking about this is that over the last 4 or 5 years or so, I've been working on this Python package that I call Isochrones. I've been inching incrementally asymptotically closer to releasing a version 2.0 of this. But if you're interested in checking this code out right now, check out the Bolo branch, because that's the sort of 2.0 development branch. So, you know, hopefully this will, you know, sometime in the next couple of weeks we'll all be official. And also, I don't have a logo. I feel like 2.0 should have a logo. So if anyone here has artistic inclinations and wants to make, I have no idea what to do about that. But it's an open call. So that can be a legacy of this workshop, if anyone's interested in or has ideas. So Isochrones grew out of some, you know, work that I did starting as a grad student on trying to compute the false positive probabilities for transiting planet candidates. And so the background for that is when you have a transit survey, you see these small periodic dips that look like transiting planets. But if you have something like a blended eclipsing binary star where the total fraction of light in your aperture from the eclipsing binary is only a small fraction of the total light, then something like a 10% dip intrinsically here might look like a 1% or a smaller dip if it's, you know, contains less, accounts for less than 10% of the light. So that might look like a transiting planet, or something like this might look like a transiting planet. If you have a grazing eclipsing binary, you might just have a shallow dip in your photometry. And these astrophysical false positives for transit surveys were, and still are, a really big deal for ground-based surveys. And so, you know, when Kepler was launched, you know, the experience in the field was that transit surveys had like 70, 80, 90% false positive rates, because that's what ground-based surveys were seeing. So there was a lot of, you know, a lot of work. You know, many people were thinking, you know, we're going to need to. Well, first of all, we had no idea what Kepler would see, right? They were looking, hoping to find a few Earths over the course of, you know, 3 years. They had no idea they would find thousands of short-period planets, right? But the idea for how they would, you know, treat the candidates once they found them was sort of still based in the old view of you follow up with as many ground-based telescopes as you can to try to rule out false positive scenarios. You know, like, you know, high-resolution imaging to see if there's any blended stars, or, you know, medium-resolution spectroscopy to see if you're dealing with an eclipsing binary situation, things like that. But what it turned out when, you know, Kepler, you know, the discoveries that it found, you know, were, you know, these thousands of transit candidates around relatively faint stars, which means each individual follow-up observation is harder, and then also all the transiting candidates were the planets. Were very small, so even like the final step that the community was used to in, you know, confirming something as a planet, which is measuring its mass and radial velocity, was basically impossible for the large majority of Kepler candidates. So what I developed was a probabilistic a way to sort of compute the probability based on, you know, astrophysically relevant prior information and information you get from the Kepler light curve to compute the probability that a signal that you see is actually a planet rather than one of these other scenarios. And the reason I'm just sort of giving a little bit of background here is this is what this isoquence package grew out of, because in order to compute the probability of these false positive scenarios, you had to do things like model all the observed, you know, like the observed photometry of a star as like a triple system or as a binary system. To see, you know, what you know, what sorts of binary systems are allowed given the observations you have of the star, and then also, of course, you know, we, you know, want to know, you know, in the same way, we need to know what the physical properties are of the star if it's just a single. So that's sort of where all this came from.
And which of these false positive scenarios is most common, per se? Something with like a 1% transit and a 3-day orbital period, something that looks like a hot Jupiter, say.
I would say this, probably.
This.
Yeah. So a blend. A lot of times, what happens with this is that you actually have, like, you know, it's not necessarily like a, you know, very close system in there, but you get sort of a fraction of the light coming from another star that sort of the wings bleed into this in the aperture, and you get this sort of like low level contamination.
Would that be even a lot worse with tests?
Yeah, so it will be. It is. Yeah. And actually, one of the things. So with Kepler, you know, one of the reasons Kepler photometry was able. So the end of the story, you know, I didn't say the conclusion of this is that we're actually able to tell that, you know, most of the Kepler, the things that look like planets in Kepler turn out to be planets and a high probability of being so. And that's kind of for several reasons. One, the Kepler pipeline did a really careful job of looking at the sort of the on-pixel location of exactly where the flux decrement was coming from. So, you know, so it wasn't a, you know, offset. It wasn't becoming offset during the eclipse. And then also, when you have really precise photometry, you can rule out things that don't have secondary eclipses. So that's something you can't do from the ground. So from the ground, you see these 1% dips, but you can't tell if there's a secondary eclipse at maybe, you know, a tenth of that level, where something like this would show that in Kepler data. Yeah.
So this is a stage. You're talking about a stage two validation. There already was some.
Yes,
stage
that's right.
One.
So there's like the raw photometry, and then you do a whole set of vetting procedures to come up with a set of candidates that you believe are planets, based on the fact that you've done these pixel level.
Right. So when we compare Kepler to TESS, you have to sort of lump both stages in.
That's right. And
say, what's the pipeline going to do, and then what are we going to
exactly.
do?
Exactly. So Kepler, we were kind of spoiled because the pipeline did such a careful job all the way through. I don't know exactly how much TESS is, you know, the pipeline is doing for that. But this is kind of a side story for the you know, just the background for, you know, where this, you know, what I'm talking about today came from. So why would I, you know, put together something like isochrones, and, you know, what's the point of this? Well, you know, this is a, you know, determining the properties of stars is really sort of one of the fundamental tasks in observational astronomy, especially if we're, you know, talking about exoplanets. And this is something that has, you know, many, many people have done this in different ways, at various, you know, documented at various levels and lots of publications. And what I wanted to do was sort of know exactly what I'm doing and be able to, you know, have something that's very reproducible and easy for people to use and say what they're doing and know exactly what they're doing, and sort of help correct some of this lack of clarity. And as I was sort of first developing this, this was about 4 years ago, I think, you know, one of the things I wanted to check was, you know, maybe we can do these slides in different order, was, you know, is what I'm getting out right? Am I doing this right? Is this consistent with what's in the literature? And so I looked at the Kepler 22 system, which was one of these famous Kepler systems. It was the first habitable zone planet that was confirmed by the Kepler team, or validated by the Kepler team. And so I just took the stellar properties from the publication and, you know, did my fitting on them. And I ended up with, like, something. So the published mass and radius were like 0.96, you know, stellar mass and radius, with like a 5500 effective temperature. And then I did my fit, and, you know, I was getting like 0.8 solar masses, you know, 0.85 solar radii, which was, you know, significantly different. I was, you know, like, what's going on? I'm, you know, let's look back at what was actually done in the paper. It said they used a series of stellar models. This is the entire content of the paper in terms of how they determine what the star is. These things are inferred, and then seven different citations, none of which I could tell, you know, which was relevant for which was done in this paper. And then the uncertainties are based on error propagation through the series of stellar models. So anyone's guess what actually happened here? And I actually emailed Dan Huber, who actually was at KITP at the time, back in 2015, on about this, because he had been, you know, working a lot on Kepler stellar properties, and he basically said, like, yeah, the results in the paper were totally garbage, and, you know, the paper was very thin on what was actually done, and, you know, cases like this make me realize why open science is a good idea. This is actually an email he sent while he was at, I guess, one of these workshops here, which is kind of cool. I just discovered this last night. So this sort of gave me some motivation that, like, this is actually a worthwhile thing to be doing, and that, you know, I it's actually, you know, maybe not incorrect.
What's the guy at DR2 you value? Out of curiosity. It could end up being a bigger planet.
I don't remember. I could look up.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I could just put in the parallax and run this again. This might, I don't think that used the parallax in that fit. Okay, so a little bit of background, and then, you know, into some more practical things, and then discussion topics. So when we talk about this, like, model-based stellar inference, we do it based on these pre-computed stellar model grids, which, for, you know, the way that I and probably most people consume these are based on tables of sort of observable or theoretical properties of stars, as a function of various sort of starting parameters of these, you know, stellar evolution calculations. So. And these grids can be organized in different ways. When you talk about isochrones, these are gridded in age and metallicity, initial metallicity. And then each of these isochrones, which share the same age, contain sort of a range of masses. And that range of masses will be different for, you know, each of the isochrones as different stars evolve and sort of your maximum mass changes. And they can also be organized, which is sort of how they're originally calculated as evolution tracks, which is it's a grid, grids in initial stellar mass and metallicity. And then each of these tracks will have a range of ages from when they're born to when the star, to when they stop the calculations. And both of these, so the MIST stellar model grids, these are based on MESA, the MESA stellar evolution code. They define and use this quantity called EEP, which is equivalent evolutionary phase, which sort of regrids. You can think of it as a reparameterization of age of the star to sort of sample, to make sure you sample the whole evolution track, with where you get enough samples when the star is evolving quickly. So you sort of define a few important evolutionary phases and then sort of have like some sort of equal number of subdivisions between those phases, and that allows you to sort of map out the places in the HR diagram where the star is evolving quickly. And sort of from a practical standpoint, this, if you're talking about isochrone grids, the EEP can be thought of as sort of a stand-in for mass. And if you're talking about evolutionary tracks, the EEP is a stand-in for age. And so it can play sort of either role depending on which organization you're using. And the reason that this is useful is because EEPs are, they're gridded as integer values. So you can have a regular grid then in three dimensions. And both, for isochrones, you can then get regular grid in age, metallicity, and EEP. For evolution tracks, you can get regular grid in mass, metallicity, and EEP. And just having regular grids make it very fast and convenient to do the interpolation. And also, interpolating using EEP instead of mass or age here is also good because when, because of this finer sampling of the evolution, the star's evolution, because if you're interpolating, in a post-main sequence star where things are changing quickly, then sort of interpolating between metallicity tracks using, age, mass, and metallicity sort of is not a reliable thing to do. And this is, something that I was doing when I originally started writing the isochrones code and, for the, all the version one series, basically. I was interpolating in age, metallicity, and mass. And that was mostly because I only cared about main sequence planet host stars, where you can do this and it's okay. But then, if you want to actually use this for other stars, which a lot of people do, then you have to be more careful about how you're doing the interpolation. Yeah?
I think this EEP, at least through the isochrone sets, I know it's kind of a standard treatment, right? Like in Basti isochrones, and I think also the Padua.
Yeah, that's right. So this was, in the last year or so, a couple years, I've been focusing most, the mold of my development has been using MIST, but the prescription for describing how to do this was from a 2016 paper, and I think a lot of everyone, I think most groups who are generating isochrones from model grids are doing this sort of thing, so which is good because that means that we can use the what we're doing with MIST and sort of plug in other models and have sort of the same organization of the grids.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
What happens at the boundaries in mass where you have qualitative changes? And
So there are for example, I think up to it's 0.65 or something. There are places where it changes in mass where the stellar evolution calculations that go into creating the grids might only go up to a certain EEP, and then up to that it goes up to higher, and so there are a few discontinuous places, and then there are also for higher mass stars an EEP number might mean different things if you're talking about a star that goes carbon burning or something in the higher mass range.
Yeah, sorry. I think one problem you may have in some cases is when when you lose monotonicity in the decay of mass, initial mass and age, right? And then this one-to-one map between age and mass is lost, and so you have to return to the rest of it.
And then just sort of some background on like what we're talking about when, at least what I'm talking about when I talk about observations in terms of, you know, fitting stellar models to observations. You know, observations can be thought of as different things. You can talk about like, you know, things like photons on CCDs or like, you know, fluxes, measured fluxes in spectral pixels at the lowest level. But you know, sort of one level up from that, you have, you know, integrated, you know, magnitudes. You might have derived atmospheric properties from spectra, you know, do a spectroscopic analysis and derive the, you know, temperatures, gravities, metallicities from that. And then you can have other kinds of observations like, you know, parallax, maybe a density if you have an eclipse, or stellar oscillation frequencies. And I'm sort of, you know, stating, you know, my sort of philosophy about this is that at a practical level, the observations you treat should be the lowest level quantities that the model grids can directly predict. So, you know, for example, if you have, you know, eclipses, you know, and you use the densities, you know, or if you have, you know, at least from, you know, using, if you're using, you know, if you have an estimate of a temperature of a star, but that temperature was derived from broadband photometry, then you should just go back to the photometry, you know, in order to fit to the grids. Is sort of how I think about it. And, you know, if a star had astroseismology measured, you know, you can just use the frequencies that, you know, instead of the sort of derived log G and temperature. Yeah.
Tim, but I get concerned about the photometry because any grid is a combination of an interior model with some atmospheric model based on top.
Yeah.
And those are usually different.
Those are different.
They're always, I think, always different groups within,
yeah,
those.
That's right.
And so you can have, for in the M-dwarfs, you can have, you know, mass radius predictions that are reasonably accurate with crazy atmosphere predictions,
yeah,
because they have the opacities wrong for TIO.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I would say you have to be a little careful if you're going to use predictions, the broadband flux predictions from evolutionary models.
Yeah, I mean, so I mean,
not actually,
I guess, no, absolutely. So this is, and I'll make this more clear in terms of what's practically happening in the code. There are sort of two different things, as you're saying, there are two different things. There's the stellar evolution calculations, and then there's the atmospheres and bolometric correction calculations. And I mean, I think more generally, you know, if you're using an observable, fitting it to the models, like, just know that's what you're doing, and that you depend on what the models are predicting, right? So, I mean, if you do have a reason that, like, you know, you have, like, a, you know, a reason to believe that you have a better measurement of the actual radius than you do of the effective temperature or something, you know, or of the predictions of the photometry, then you can use the radius, you know. So, like, this is all sort of what you use as data, and, you know, where you trust the models is all kind of how, that's like where all the devil is in all of this. And
when we had this discussion, should we actually use models for M-dwarfs at all? Right. I mean, is it all, we have empirical relations between various quantities now. Does anyone actually use isochronics to derive quantities of uncommon M-dwarf at the moment?
More broadly, though, yeah, if you're trusting some, you're using some model output from an evolutionary code. If you're using photometry, that's actually not from the evolutionary,
yeah,
code.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, in the atmosphere.
Right, so there's, and one of the ways that I've developed the isochronous package is that you can mix and match the, like, bolometric correction grid and the model grid and sort of see how much that affects the results, at least in principle. It's all set up to be able to do that.
I just mentioned one more thing.
Yeah.
You have the integrated broadband fluxes. And
yeah.
Not what most surveys publish is magnitudes.
Right.
Which is sort of right, because most surveys actually measure the brightness of stars relative to each other. So there's,
yes,
a whole issue there of the 0 points between, yeah, like, different.
Yes, and that's right. So that's something that I am probably less aware of than I should be. Sort of like the way I've been approaching this is kind of like, let's believe the data, let's believe the models. And the observer's like, you can't believe the data, and the theorist, you can't believe the models. So, you know, just kind of stuck in the middle here. And but this is what, you know, we do the models in order to try to get these things, you know, got to paste it together somehow. And I guess that's one reason we're all here. Okay, so then just to talk about, you know, what I mean by inference, by, you know, how do we put together these observations and these models, neither of which we believe. So, you know, you get a set of observed properties, you know, for example, magnitudes, parallax, and then we have the parameters. You choose the parameters of your model, and the parameters that, you know, sort of depending on what organization of the isochron, what organization of the stellar model grids you're using, the parameters might be EEP, age, metallicity, distance, extinction, or mass, EEP, metallicity, distance, extinction. So this is sort of, you know, swapping out the EEP, replacing the mass or the age. And then, you know, have some uncertainties that you believe also in these observations and put them together into a likelihood. And then computation of this likelihood, you know, in principle, it requires you to be able to predict whatever observations you've made at an arbitrary set of these model parameters. So that's where interpolation of these grids comes in. And then the other half of inference is your priors. Pierre sort of brought this up a little bit the other day, last week. But out of all these parameters, you know, some of them are very straightforward, so you can put some prior on mass, you know, some IMF, age, metallicity, distance, extinction. These are all things that you can make sensible priors for that are pretty much separable. Those can just be sort of univariate functions. But then this EEP is where all of this sort of subtlety about things moving through the evolution at different speeds, and you know, needing different parts of the HR diagram to be weighted differently depending on what track you're on, and things like that. So the prior on EEP is, you know, if it's being used to as a standard for mass, you can have a physical prior on the mass, and then sort of do this transformation here, where you can calculate this quantity, you can compute it numerically on the same grid, on the grid of, you know, you have your grid, your model grid, you can just compute the, you know, DM, DEP numerically, and then you can evaluate this quantity as a function of age and metallicity, just like you compute everything else. And this actually turns out to work, which was fun the first time it worked. I was like, yeah, that works. It's like some simple math, but it works. And then for an evolution track grid, you would just, you know, switch the M and the T's up here. Any questions about this? Because this was a sort of a subject of consternation last week, but I think this is a totally fine thing to do.
Pierre's comment was related to inference. So, for example, if you want to determine the posterior of helium, right? If you would need to include in that Jacobian part the behavior of your parameters or of helium with respect to your parameters, right?
Yeah. So, if you can imagine one of the discussion points later is if you wanted to also have like y as one of these parameters, and you had a grid, you know, another, you know, different grids at different helium abundances, then this would be one of the parameters, and then, you know, this derivative would then be a function of metallicity, age, and helium. Right. So the point is, like this does vary, you know, like as a function of these other parameters, and this is a sort of multivariate way to, you know, to make sure that you're evaluating this at the right metallicity and age. Cool. Okay, so I promise this is not a tutorial. But there's some code. This is what this looks like practically. So there's this sort of a you know, convenience function to get a missed isochron and declare what bands you want. And so this is getting to what Phil was saying. And this is in the sort of 2.0 evolution of this code, where there's now this grid here has two separate things. It has a, like an isochron grid and a bolometric correction grid. And these are, you know, if you have a different one of these, you can swap it out and they calculate things differently. And just to show like what's inside of these, each of these grids is sort of backed by a pandas data frame. This is just showing the first few rows. It's sort of it's a multi-index data frame that represents the regular grid. This is why regular grids are so nice. So here, like the log age, the metallicity, and the EEP are the gridding parameters. And this is just the very beginning of the grid for model grid. And of course, this has all of the computed, all of the theoretically computed values at all of these points. And then the bolometric correction grid, you know, is a grid in temperature, gravity, metallicity, and extinction. And then for whatever bands that you requested, I just requested JHK. So that's kind of what's under the hood there. These are the parameters that this thing uses, and then these are the columns that get interpolated. If we want, let's say, the mass, radius, and temperature at a certain value of EEP, age, and metallicity, you can just, you interp value, and it grabs those columns and interpolates those at those points. And notice that here, the interp value, this is only going back to the theoretical model grids. So this doesn't have anything to do, it doesn't have the distance or extinction in here, because that has to do with photometry and the bolometric corrections. If you want to do, look at, what are the predicted magnitudes at a set of parameters, now we need the distance and extinction there, give it the bands, and this returns because it has to compute these anyway, in order to interpolate on the bolometric corrections, you get the temperature, gravity, and metallicity out also, from this call, and you get the photometry. What next? Oh, and then, often, if you, let's say, you want to generate a synthetic population of stars, you usually don't know care what the EEP is. You want to know masses, ages, metallicities. So there is a way that you can just give mass, age, and metallicity, and what happens here is there's sort of a it uses both the I don't know how right this is or anything, but it's kind of cute and it works. It uses both the evolution track grids and the isochron grids, and sort of demands consistency, and so it interpolates in one because. Like one will give you have to give the EEP to age and metallicity, and then that predicts a mass. And then the other one you can give the EEP to age and metallicity, and that predicts. You can predict the fourth quantity, you interpolate the fourth quantity on the grid, from the grid parameters, and then you sort of find the value of EEP that minimizes the differences between your requested values here. And so this is not something that you want to do like. When you're, running an inference, when you're, computing the likelihood in a MCMC, because it requires, hundreds sometimes of computations. But if you're generating a population of stars, you can do that, and you can do it sort of more accurately. So like there's sort of a quick and dirty way, and then there's a more accurate way that does like an actual solver, and you see that there's a little bit of difference between the predicted EEP here. But things like, the radius between these two are temperatures are pretty close. And if you wanted to, you can here pass several masses and it gives a table back of all of the properties, for those. And just real quick, I did Kepler 100 as an example here because this was... In Diana's talk last week, that was the little planet that was farthest off of the Earth-like section. So I just put in the observed you know, properties, sort of guessing at some uncertainties for Gaia photometry, two mass, a spectroscopic temperature, astroseismic frequencies, and parallax, and fit this. It takes a couple minutes. Let's see here. So there's, with this, you know, corner parameters, corner params here, it gives you the sort of correlation diagram of all of the sampling parameters. So we have EEP, age, distance, you know, metallicity, extinction. But that's usually not, we're usually more interested in physical properties. So you can look at mass, radius, age, you know, things like that. And interestingly, it's not, okay, and, oh yeah, so let me just look at this real quick. So this is the, you can make these corner observed plots, which is often very useful because, you know, when you're fitting properties of a star, usually you might be like taking broadband magnitudes from different surveys, and this is getting to the zero point issues. And what you want to see in this plot is that all of the blue, you kind of get blue crosshairs in your bullseyes. Because that means that your samples are predicting the observations that you're constraining the likelihood with. So you know, we see here that the J magnitude is a little bit off. It's a little bit inconsistent from what the models predict for everything else. And you know, it's just like minor red flags if you're off of, you know, like sometimes you'll make a diagram like this, and you know, the photometry from one survey will just be like way off of everything else, and you know that there's something going funny with your data. You might want to, you know, change what inputs you're using. What I found here, this doesn't like totally fix what Diana was saying, but you know, the radius on the exoplanet archive is 1.49 for the star, and this comes up with 1.55, so it's a little bit bigger star, makes the planet a little bit bigger. Doesn't help that much, but anyway.
You know what was used for the for Kepler 100 in the literature to derive radius?
This is from
parallax.
I don't know what Diana's using in her paper. This is just from what's on the Exoplanet Archive, which I think was from the like MARSI 2014, you know, summary paper of like lots of these things. So. You can also fit the same star as a binary star. So if you're interested in like what potential stellar binary scenarios could be hiding in there, you know, if you had a close binary, what does the photometry allow? Photometry parallax combination. There's not a whole lot of, it's not super interesting, but there's like a 0.3 to 0.4 solar mass secondary that the data like to be there. It's not being pushed. Like sometimes when you do these binary fits, the secondary just wants to be as faint as possible and just like an invisible M dwarf. But this, you know, there is some preference for you know, a something. not that I'm not saying that there's a binary star here. This doesn't look whole lot different.
What is driving that preference in this case?
I have no idea. I don't know. I think it's just flux? there's probably some just kind of subtle moving around of the like Y's and two mass photometry to try to make it a little bit better likelihood. I don't think it's strong, but
you think it's the red and
there's one thing that is different, and I probably can't. Can I zoom in here? Okay. So, a little bit buggy. Okay. That didn't work super hot. So, this last, you can't see the level here, but this is the extinction here. So, this is being allowed to float to whatever. In the binary model, like very low extinctions, like close to zero, which is probably what it is, and just because the star is not that far away, are a little bit more favored than in the single star model, where so it looked like things are a little bit more red. Where is this? So here,
yeah. So basically the star is redder.
So the star is a little bit redder than this would be predicted. And here, this is getting kind of absorbed into like saying there's a little bit more extinction.
Yeah.
And here, that's getting first absorbed into the binary companion. So for whatever that's worth.
Do you always assume that they're physically associated, that the parallax applies to both the primary and the secondary? Do you allow for blanks?
There are ways, you can do it by allowing for completely different unassociated things, but there are fast optimized ways that assume that they're associated, which is what I'll run here. Because you're talking about 6 parameters versus 10. So that's a difference also. And just kind of to show, what else you can get here, you have your, again, your sampling parameters, and then you have these drive samples that those observed plots were showing. This is the radius of the primary, which is actually slightly smaller than it was in this for the single star model. Don't know why. But these are all of the things that are, all the drive samples that are computed. And so you can do things like, let's say we were curious about, what would the blending fraction be? So if there were a secondary companion in the system, how much, what's the amount of flux that it would contribute to the total light? So from these samples, the Kepler magnitude of the primary is 11, and the secondary is 17.7. So there's a very small fraction of the light would be from the secondary. So even if there were a secondary here, it wouldn't change the radius of the planet very much. Just be less than a percent, and then also if you were interested in maybe the planet could be transiting the secondary star instead of the primary, you probably would have noticed that in your light curve fit, because the density of this is 12 versus 0.5, and so just you can look at these binary parameters like that, and I will just. That's all sort of I have to serve you guys. Things that are topics that are open to exploration and discussion. As I said right now, the IsoCrones is only implemented in MIST stellar models, and any other model grids that have publicly served grids that have EEP is computed and served as part of the grids. I'd be very interested in those should be relatively easy to plug in to this current code, and same thing with tables of bolometric correction. I don't know if there are other publicly served tables other than the MIST grids, but I would be interested in hearing about that. Sort of from a computational side, I've been thinking for a while that computationally it's probably a lot better to sort of compute the log likelihood on the grid and then interpolate in that, rather than interpolate in all the individual properties. This might be a little bit better. So that's just kind of throwing that out there. And then, should sort of standard inference open up more dimensions of interpolation, such as alpha abundance and Hilbert fraction, and sort of how we might do that with existing grids. We're already talking about a lot of gigabytes for the grids that we have, and sort of adding more dimensions makes that problem worse. But I'm sure we can, in the future that will be, we can mitigate that. And sort of the central question here is how can model-based inference like this complement data-driven methods to help us learn physics? So that's a very open question. But we know that the models are imperfect. But how can we use, do people have ideas on how we can use inference based on these models to try to improve the models and to learn what's happening in stars? And I'm happy to talk about any of these things. Anyone has ideas, or if people are curious more about isochrones or planet false positive calculations, can talk forever about that.
Picking up your last point.
Yeah.
One of the things I did when I wrote something which doesn't do well, when I wrote PageMath, which does a similar sort of, tackles a similar problem, was to write it on a sample of eclipse and binary stars. So actually, just treating each star individually. And then once you've done that, you get the predicted mass, but you know the actual masses, and similarly with the radii. you can then start plotting residuals against other things to see where things are going wrong. That's interesting. So you can, for example, see, are the fast rotating stars, do they have, is there some sort of trend with like mass error with rotation or abundance or whatever it is, and as a way of actually exploring the, you know, where in the model is going wrong, and does it sort of relate to some other parameter, for example, is there some systematic error with mechanicity, rotation, whatever there is.
Yeah, I like the thought. I think the like eclipsing binary samples are, you know, very important for this sort of thing, because it allows you to sort of different, completely different ways of measuring mass versus, and you can see what the models predict.
And not just eclipsing binaries, so also the visual binaries with good masses. There's a few of those around as well, where you've got
The orbits
and the radial velocities. There's a program of that, for example, that you've been through. Hogwatch, I think, is doing, anyway, there are those samples are out there, and they're interesting to test again.
Yeah. I'll just move notes.
So on the first point, I think the EEPs are super useful, and I've found that super useful as well for using MIST. Mm-hmm. Do you know, I remember Aaron Dotter's paper that explains the whole EEP scheme.
Yeah.
He actually published some codes, and I don't remember whether you can just, can you just use that code and apply it to another evolutionary track grid, or do you actually need the source codes to run, like, Yonsei Yale to actually calculate the EEP? In other words, could we do this ourselves?
Yeah, so I think the answer is yes.
Calculate the EEPs and then put them all in.
Yes, so I think the answer to that is definitely yes. There's I think, experience and like fudging around a little bit to figure out, you know, like what are the good, like where to put the EEPs as a function of metallicity, and you know, and so there's a lot of that stuff. Like that's all, like, you know, in terms of code, it's all easy, but in terms of like figuring out actually where to put all those numbers for the different grids, you know, would require some sort of local expertise on what's, I mean, so there is probably some way to do it where you, you know, look for a certain fraction of, you know, the convective layer versus, you know, something.
Right.
You know, so there's, it is described in the paper sort of roughly how it's done, and that could be applied to other grids.
And I remember this code too to do it. I just think this would be a very important thing for us to do, is to provide tools.
So actually,
then the exoplanet community uses the derived masses, and as we've discussed right there.
Yeah, so it might be even better, you know, even better than sort of the, you know, like one level more of like clarity of, you know, what's being done would be to have a tool like this, just take this to the model, the evolution track grids, and then actually compute the isochron grids from that, and for that to be like a, you know, done the same way between different, you know, different grids of models. Yeah, you know, so that's something that, you know, technically it's not a difficult thing to do, but it requires some like expertise, I think.
You might have to be careful with some grids; it just might not be published at high enough density to actually define the EEP where you need it. And if you've got some nasty blue hook feature and they just haven't calculated many models through there, that's.
But there are at least three or four that are pretty dense, like parsec models. You can download whatever resolution you want. A couple, and if we put those in your code and whatever else we have, then the community can actually say, oh, I'll calculate my mass with three this different mass, grids, and the uncertainty, you know, the difference in those masses is actually much larger.
Exactly. So
you get out.
I think the point is that because there are these two sets of EEPs, right? So the main EEPs, which are easy to find because they are basically just some key points in the HR diagram, but then it's how you assign the secondary ones, right? So you have, I don't know, zero H main sequence and turn off to say something, right?
Yeah.
So it's how you assign in between, right? And then, so here you use this kind of metric, so to account for equivalent points in different tracks. And the point is how you compute this metric, right? So if you need some information that might not be available as a standard output from other grids, right?
Yeah.
To say, central grids, for example, which is something some people might not consider as relevant when publishing isochron. So this is the kind of check one you need to do to say.
And I think, yeah, I think that, you know, like what I would, you know, I don't know if any of you are involved in the process of generating grid system models, but from a standpoint of like firewalling expertise and different things, I would much prefer that grids are computed, you know, sampled nicely where they need to be sampled and with the EEPs, you know, just out there. So, you know, I don't have to worry about the intricate details of the stellar models in order to connect them to the observations.
So can you repeat, what would you want?
Yeah, so if you publish grids of stellar models,
yeah,
that, you know, one of the columns is...
To include already a...
Just like the simple, like, you know... Because presumably you've done some resampling and like sampling different places and just have that be reflected in the EEP column, and that's, and then you can use that in the interpolation.
You're not worried about that being defined differently by different groups though?
No, because it's not, because it only matters internally. Like, you know, you're not comparing and it's like, oh, I got a EEP of 12 from this model and 500 from it. It doesn't, you know, it's not a physical quantity. It's just what allows you to compute the physical quantities by interpolation. So
it has to be consistent within a set of
models. So for example, like the Aaron Daughter's group, who, you know, was made MIST and the previously made the Dartmouth models, like the Dartmouth also had EEP that was like a max of like up to 350, and MIST goes to like 1600 or something. You know, so it just depends on how you've chopped it up. So it only matters internally.
I think the issue is here that if you're going to use bridge models and interpolate in them, you end up doing something like the EEP anyway, because you can't interpolate in that image. It doesn't work. Yeah. So everyone comes up with slightly different ways of doing it if there isn't something provided, right? So you end up doing something like interpolating in fraction of the main sequence lifetime, which some people use that. The bonsai people just use an arc length factor. They just sort of start with a, you know, they just plot the track and just see how far has it moved from the origin in some plane and so on. So everyone ends up doing this in a slightly different way because you have to. And actually, it would be better if the people who produce the models did it, because they presumably know better which would work best.
So as long as there's a well-defined procedure, that's enough. You don't need it to be sort of standardized.
Yeah, although since there seems to be a fairly good one there with, you know, the Cosmos our way of doing it, that would be even nicer.
So is that knowledge with Aaron only? Do we have local MESA experts that we can...
Local MESA?
If we only had MESA expertise. Maybe local MESA experts aren't interested.
Adam Germain, right?
But he works MESA.
Yeah, and Evan has used MESA a lot, and I have. I wouldn't say I'm an expert on any of these creation ideas. What are the other interpolation dimensions available? So right now it's just limited by whatever the MIST.
Yeah. So for example, what MIST serves is they have a set of grids that are, I don't know if they offer different alpha abundances or not. I think there might be a zero and like a 0.4 or something. There's some. There's like maybe two discrete values of alpha, and I don't think MIST offers different values of y, but the Yale, like the YAPSI grids, you know, offer different values of y, and then also MIST has like a rotating and a non-rotating set of tracks. So I could imagine, you know, going to different values. I don't think that's one of the things, but that's another. So, yeah, I mean, and you know, going to, you know, if like one or more thing, if we actually want to try to, probably the first stage in doing this sort of thing is like, just, you know, having grids at different values, like different fixed values of these, and then what's the difference with this value versus this value, instead of trying to go between all of them.
If you wanted to try to measure the mass of a red giant just based on its position on the HR diagram, it would totally depend on what makes it like you choose, right? And that's probably going to be the dominant source of uncertainty in your mass. But
yeah, so then it would be good to have
four in many works because there was
just hard on one side. Yeah, exactly. So that would be, you know, the sort of first order thing to do for that would be to have, you know, MIST or whatever grids are serving you, like have like two options for just to see, like, look at the sensitivity of the results to, you know, one of these like fixed parameters.
What dimension would you prioritize the most? What new dimension?
I don't know. This would be. I mean, maybe mixing length if you're interested in evolved stars. You know.
Actually, mixing length if you're interested in active stars as well, because there's this whole issue to do inflated radii for like MK stars. So when we did the base mass interpolator, we have like a standard grid, and we have a low alpha NLT mixing length grid. So you can see, you know, if I have one of these sort of inflated stars, is that a reasonable explanation? This sort of idea of inhibited convection, does that come into it? And also helium abundance, because you get some stars when you do their densities actually come out below the isochrones, and then you're sort of stuck thinking, well, what do I do now? what you can do is you say, well, how much helium would I need to match that star? And then you can decide whether that's more likely than the possibility that you've messed up your analysis. Some of them come out well below the isochrones, so, and for no obvious reason from the intrinsic data.
So just so I understand the challenge here,
yeah.
Making an evolutionary model for a star mesa is really straightforward.
Yeah.
But then making the isochrones is a little harder because it's taking dynamic steps. And so
I think it's mostly a thing of it's like organization, bookkeeping, and like a lot of them.
Okay.
Like, I don't think there's any fundamental issues here. You know, like, you want to make sure that you, like, when you're making the isochrones, you do it carefully, so you're interpolating nicely between tracks. But that's a solved problem, as you know, as far, you know, as Dotter paper and other. I don't think there's like large uncertainties about how to do that.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about how to make this EEP thing with mixing and changing.
I think all you would do is you would just create another grid just like you did before with a different value of mixing length for the whole.
Are the actual input files available for the MIS? So you say, oh, well, you just, you know, take that parameter and change it and rerun. The thing is, are you really going to be running in exactly the same way? Because you might run the grid and see differences, and you want to be sure it's actually different to the parameter you think you're varying, and not because of some obscure version.
Your first run will
so that's
the old version, or mm-hmm. maybe you already have, try to reproduce a few tracks, and then...
Yeah. MIS models are reproducible. Yeah, and published a lot of information.
Yeah, and also the...
Well, you've got the input file, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of options.
Yeah.
Are you using the same description for overshooting? Are you using the same definition of the cellular abundance?
So clearly the best, I mean, I would say the best solution to that is whoever's curating a set of models, you know, it's most likely for it to be consistent if the same group has, like, mixing length A, mixing length B, you know, with everything else fixed. And
I think that's why you get it with the proliferation of models, right? Because somebody said, oh, well, this grid doesn't quite do what I want, I'll just change this one parameter. And they do the sensible thing of first trying to recreate the initial grid, and it doesn't match, so you end up doing a whole new set every time. Which is why I think the MESA and MIST initiative is very good, because it sounds like this. That shouldn't be necessary.
Have you looked at the interpolation error? So interpolate to some set of parameters and then rerun MESA with those parameters, perhaps rerun the atmosphere if you can get access to the atmosphere codes, and see if that matches your interpolated predictions to quantify the interpolation error.
No. but I think there's a hint of that in like what I was doing here, which is basically like interpolating the different directions, the different kinds of, you know. So if I were to just do this, so for example, if you, you know, like interpolate the track grid at a given mass, EEP, and metallicity, and then see what the interpolated age is, and then put that age back in for like the isochrone grid at that same EEP that you put in here, then the mass would be slightly different from what you put in there. So like there's a little bit of like slight inconsistencies at the level of this, you know, in interpolating the different directions. But yeah, and I think things like that might get helped a little bit by interpolating in the log likelihood instead of in the individual parameters, because then there's just one. I don't know if that helps, but you know, does it not help, Dan?
Yeah,
I don't think so.
Shaking head. Okay.
You could rerun meshes, you know, yeah, if not everywhere, at least.
No. No, that's an interesting idea.
What you usually do is you compute your isochrons by removing a few tracks and see if you can reconstruct, for example, the interpolation. You can interpolate the isochrons and reconstruct the
Yeah,
for example, in Aaron's paper in 2016, there is an example there, which it's the best example, but you can do this. And it usually works very well, except when you have fast transitions in the physics. So, for example, when convective cores develop, then because the tracks behave kind of discontinuously. Right? So that's the dangerous part. But for the rest, it works usually very well.
Yeah, I don't think interpolation error is a dominant source of uncertainty here.
Yeah, that was the focus of your talk, so I wanted to focus on that.
I don't know if there's anything that anyone else wants to talk about in particular, but if anyone is interested, there's new documentation up, at least draft documentation for the new version of this that will be coming out soon at this/isochrons. We've got like half hour left, but I don't want to keep you. Is there anything else that we should cover?
Just if you have the Gibson binaries, you have additional constraints on things like the luminosity ratio between two components in a band. Can that be included?
Sure. So the because at any given, you have your primary properties, secondary properties, the grids predict the luminosity of each, and you can have the luminosity ratio be one of the factors in the likelihood.
Oh, I'm calculating my own likelihood. So yeah, this doesn't calculate the likelihood for you, it just does the...
It does, no. I would, it's not currently implemented, but it would be relatively easy to do.
I own likelihood function do exactly that.
So for example, I could have a, I can imagine, and this might be an interesting thing to try maybe these weeks, is to have a, I showed the single star model, the binary star model. There could be like an eclipsing binary star model where you have sort of constraints, where it's expecting constraints on the densities and the luminosity ratios or mass ratios or whatever you have. And then that would be definitely doable. All right. I can let you guys go. No need to stick around.
Thanks, Sam.